All right, so this is part two of the interview with Richard Lindblad. And we're going to start really with when did you first hear that there was going to be a federal civil commitment program? Whose idea was it? Where'd you hear about it?
Well, whose idea was it? I'm not sure. It was one that was getting a lot of attention. California had a civil commitment program, and New York had a civil commitment program. And many of the people in the field were unhappy with the lack of aftercare services at the two hospitals. And so there was a fairly large groundswell of interest in doing something with aftercare in home communities at about the same time. And several of the conferences that were held on the topic included people from both California and New York talk about their programs. And I guess it's the Schaefer report that called for it. I'm not sure, one of the congressional reports actually called for initiation of a civil commitment program at the federal level.
Now, were the programs in California and New York successful?
They were more successful than the federal government programs. The one in California was fairly well evaluated by Doug Anglin and Bill McLaughlin, and they showed some real success. The one in New York, I'm not sure who the evaluators were, but I don't know if that had quite the same rigor of their studies as did the one in California. But nonetheless, they were fairly successful by the standards that existed out there at the time. And so federal civil commitment law was passed. And off the record, the date that you have, I think it was something I read of yours, was not the accurate date.
Yeah.
So.
I've recently run into different dates.
Well, I've got the original law.
Okay,
I'll get the
real date. Yeah. It's been hard. It was hard to track down.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you can even find it. A copy. I looked on the internet trying to find the copy of the original law, and I couldn't find it. I do have a copy of it, though.
Okay, that's good. And let's get the numbers and just make sure everything is right, because it is, we tried to research NARA and there's just not much on it. All right, so you weren't involved at all with any of the lobbying or any of the sort of
original ideas?
No,
I was basically doing the things I did at Fort Worth. And when we got this conference on the book I was showing you.
Oh, it was upstairs.
that was about the time that NARA, it hadn't been signed into law, but that was, everybody knew it was going to happen. And that's when Sherm Kiefer became quite involved with it. And Stan Yolis asked him to come to Washington to implement the law. And Sherm was here for a period here. At that time, we were down in the Barlow building and down Wisconsin Avenue. And he called upon me because he had some experience with me at Fort Worth. He was deputy director down there at the time. And he called upon me and he called upon Bob Carrick, who was in charge of the sophomore house, and called upon Karst Bestman, and he called upon a guy named Ernie Fiegel, who was a social worker who had worked at Lexington. And he brought us all to headquarters. And we were responsible for putting the program together. Another player who was in it very briefly was a fellow named Glenn Petty. Glenn came from the probation department, so he had a little orientation on the criminal element associated with it. NARA was a fascinating law because it basically forced a marriage between the Bureau of Prisons, the Attorney General, and the Surgeon General. And so there were several titles in it, and the Surgeon General was responsible for implementing Titles 1 and Titles 3, and the Attorney General was Title 2, which was commitment to the prosecution. Title 1 was, I hope I have those title numbers correct. That might have to be checked, I'm sure. Title I was voluntary commitment. Title I was voluntary commitment. Title III was. I'll just have to correct that. One was actually sentenced to aftercare by the judge. One was in lieu of prosecution, and one was strictly voluntary. Mm-hmm. And I'll have to look at the legislation. At any rate, all of them required a close working relationship between the Surgeon General and the Attorney General because of the different pieces of paper that had to be processed to get the person through the whole system. And it was because of those different legal documents that the law became so cumbersome that many people didn't want to mess with it because it just kept a lot of busy work and feedback to the courts, and the courts weren't happy with what was happening in some cases. And so sometimes they quit using it. Other judges thought it was the best law in the world, and they just loaded our hospitals up with the people from certain cities and so on. But we set forth implementing the law by, first of all, we knew that we had to set up contracts in key communities across the nation to provide both treatment and aftercare. And we knew we didn't have anything, so we recruited a group of young social workers straight out of their graduate program, provided them training, and gave them the responsibility to go into these communities and try to do, they did community assessments and try to identify potential providers of care in the communities for these clients.
Now, were these what you were calling field offices?
We divided the nation, first of all, into three different sections. There was a field office in Chicago, a field office in New York, and a field office in Los Angeles. We then, as the program grew and became more of a need for them, we also opened one in Atlanta and I think one in Philadelphia. Neither of the latter two had any size at all. And these field offices, we had a person in charge of each field office. The three of us were area supervisor, FADO headquarters. Then we had a field office supervisor, and then they had the young staff going out doing the work. And it was their responsibility to come up with potential contracts for aftercare and for evaluation and for treatment. And we were successful in getting a lot of those contracts out in a very short period of time.
And you were describing something like if even one person from a particular town needed aftercare, what would you do?
Yeah, well, if there was a number of little communities where the judge decided that they wanted this particular person to get involved in the program, he got them committed to the Surgeon General for care. And the law required the Surgeon General provide aftercare services for them. So we obviously didn't have any real mechanism to provide that aftercare service, so we would go into these little towns wherever they were and find a community agency or somebody who would be willing to provide the service to that individual, provide aftercare, give us reports on his progress, do urine testing on him, and there was urine testing available for opiates, and report back to us. And in order to do that, we gave them a contract. We called them purchase orders, and they were a maximum we could give was $2,500 per client.
For a year.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many of those purchase orders we had, but we, not a lot. I'm guessing maybe 20 or 30. Most of ours were done under larger contracts in the more metropolitan areas.
But you sometimes had to fly out to these places and set things up for just one person.
Exactly, and we did that many times. Exactly. And We had quite a team going around. There was a person with the contracting office who had become sophisticated in these particular aftercare contracts, and we had our staff who were well trained. And after they had met with the social agencies that expressed some interest, we would work with them, developing, making sure they could respond to a scope of services that we had set up. And if they were willing to do that, the contracting officer came and they negotiated a contract based upon that agency's cost, overheads, and so on. And some contracts were as little as $35,000 for 20 patients. Some of them were $50,000, just depending on the area and so on.
Now, what about how were the federal hospitals being used at that time? How were they, what was their role in the implementation of NARA?
Initially, they were not supposed to be involved in the implementation. But what happened? The admissions to the program became more than we could handle through our community contracts. So the decision was made, just sheer numbers for being admitted. So a decision was made very early on that we would send all the NARA patients to either Fort Worth or Lexington for the evaluation and the treatment phase, simply because we didn't have the capability out in the communities. And so they did become basically the conduit through which NARA patients got into aftercare. Most of the people who were in the hospital became NARA clients rather than prisoner clients at that time. With the creation of NIDA, which was a little bit after NARA was passed, both of the hospitals became renamed as clinical research centers.
Didn't that happen in the 60s, not the 70s? The clinical research centers? I think that happened before NIDA. I think it was...
You're right. You're absolutely right.
In fact, isn't there something in the legislation
you're absolutely right.
That did that?
Exactly right.
Okay, so, all right, so I'll go back and correct that. But, so why was that? Why were they renamed clinical research centers?
Well, because prior to that, they were part of the division of the hospitals. Division of Hospitals, the Bureau of Medical Services, I think it was. And then they became part of NIMH, and so it was better to call them research centers under NIMH. That's what happened.
And what was the role of NIMH in NARA?
It was the bureau that actually was implementing it. Donata was part of NIMH. And Stan Yolis, who was the director of NIMH, appointed Sherman Kiefer to implement the law. And the very first phases of it occurred under
IMH. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you sometimes were assigned to Lexington?
Because we went to do the evaluations down there, and because we had a set up aftercare program out of Lexington, I was going to Lexington almost on a weekly basis to work with the NARA staff down there. They had a unit down there doing the evaluations. And especially in the early period of it, they had no knowledge of the NARA program and what was required and what was expected of them and their reports and how they were to make their decisions based upon what the law called for and so on. And so it was just a very intensive period of training of their staff and so on.
And my sense was that NARA had this disorganizing effect on Lexington, that people didn't know what to do.
I think that's right, because NARA represented a whole different approach to addiction. Even though many of the patients were the same that they'd seen before, they were now under a different type of legislation, and the role of the security and the guards and the Bureau of Prison had been greatly reduced. And so, yeah, I think that's right. And then when Dr. Conrad went there as the director of it, he brought a much more liberal orientation to the program down there, I think, than had been existing in the past. And the whole Lexington-Fort Worth treatment program sort of participated.
Mm-hmm. So earlier you were saying that there was a different pattern of assessment or an unevenness in how the psychiatric evaluations were done between the two hospitals. Can you describe that again?
I think the data would clearly show that the number of people who were found not suitable for treatment at Fort Worth was significantly greater than those that went to Lexington. And I attribute that primarily to more of a liberal approach to the evaluation than occurred at Fort Worth. Fort Worth maintained, I think, a stronger Bureau of Prison orientation than did Lexington during that transition period. And so it took very little acting out on the part of a client at Fort Worth and he would be found not suitable for treatment. Whereas in Lexington, they often turned their head to that and said, this person is a candidate, ought to be given an opportunity for treatment and aftercare. And so the numbers reflect that rather dramatically. And there really should be no reason for that much variation because, you know, same program, same group of people were being committed.
Did anybody think that was a problem at the time?
Yeah, I'm sure many people thought it was a problem, or certainly an unusual occurrence. I don't think anybody was that concerned, willing to take on the task of trying to change it. Mm-hmm. You have to keep in mind that this was a program that didn't exist, and then almost overnight it was just all over the United States. And there were clients receiving care all over the United States, and just a very small handful of us were trying to make this happen. And we were on planes every week. We traveled all over the United States, always on travel between the two hospitals, all the metropolitan areas. I can't tell you how many trips I've taken. Carson and I one time had an emergency landing over Detroit because, we were flying in to give a seminar there. He'll talk about that if you bring it up, that how we almost didn't leave Detroit that day. But I think there were a lot of things that we questioned. When you look at it, even at the time, we were aware that there was things that were not what we had hoped to have happened. We had contracts to do urine testing. Some of our laboratories were not as good as other laboratories. Some laboratories found higher rates of positives than others did. That was terrible because if a person was found positive, when they were in aftercare, we did regular urine tests on them to make sure they were still clean. If they came up with a positive, they were sent back to treatment, and that meant going back to wherever they had treatment, which usually was Fort Worth or Lexington. So an awful lot of people got to aftercare, were dirty, were sent back. Mm-hmm. And again, there was inconsistency on that based upon where the urine testing was done. Well, those were issues that we were trying to work on and straighten out. Unfortunately, sometimes a patient suffered because of the newness of the program. You know.
Why did you scale it up so quickly? Why not go slower and do it in places you knew were harder hit than others?
It was we did not have control of the spigot. The courts had control. The law was passed. It clearly said the Attorney General would petition the court. If the court found them to be an addict, they would send them for evaluation, which they did every time. Overnight, we just hadn't worked. The Surgeon General, i.e., NIMH, had all of these clients who were in the system, had to do something for them. And the courts were not at all interested in saying, hearing from us, that we can't handle them at this point. You know. It was a big, big task in a very short time.
Yeah. So you started working on it when exactly?
Well, let's see, I guess about 1968, I guess, something of that nature. The law was passed in 86. 66. And then in 68, I started working on it.
And you said you saw the first NARA patient? And where was that? When was that?
Well, he was committed from Washington, D.C. His name was Feeney. And he was actually even committed before we had any program going. Let me see what that is. I remember we used to joke because we had all just arrived in Washington, D.C. and all of a sudden we found out that the first patient had been committed to NARA, and we didn't even know hardly what NARA was or what we were supposed to do, but we knew there was a patient in somewhere in the pipeline that we had to take care of, which we did, of course.
So what did you do? You found him?
Yeah, we got a contract with somebody to take care of him in the community. It was a good lesson about how rapidly the system operates.
So these, the people you were contracting with, some of them were already treatment programs or aftercare programs?
Very few were, actually, because if you think about it, in those years, nobody wanted to deal with drug addicts. Drug addicts had a very negative image, partly because of Anslinger and all the stuff he put forth on them, but we had a heck of a time getting programs to be willing to care for the addicts. And perhaps the most reluctant dragons were the community mental health centers. Simply, although we did end up having contract with several of the big community mental health centers, to the most part they did not want to have their hands dirty with addicts. They had heard all the stories about how addicts would steal property and steal this and the other thing.
So you had to convince them?
Yeah, it was rather a big sales job, really. We had to go in there and tell them what the attic was, what to expect, what the Surgeon General was willing to do to protect them, and to cover any costs that they may have. The contracts were relatively liberal for the number, cost-wise, from the number of patients they were treating. In other instances, we were given contracts to programs like, in Chicago, for example, there was a Catholic charities program that had a little outreach thing for addicts, and we wrote a contract with them. And same up in Minnesota. And there were a scattering of halfway houses and people who were doing little pieces of work, and those were very happy to get contract funds because it gave them a little bit of funding.
And so by liberal, what do you mean? What were the costs like?
Well, the way the law was written, if the counselor decided that a person who was addicted needed to have, say, a set of tools in order for him to go to work, the agency, we had a contract, could literally provide tools to that patient so that this guy could work. They had to get approval from us, but on the other hand, if they wrote a fairly convincing letter why something had to be done, they usually got it funded. Now, tools was perhaps an extreme, but that there were many times when the counselor decided that somebody ought to take a course or to do this, that, or the other thing, and then we would pay for it. The Surgeon General was very liberal in paying for under that program, in paying for all the needs that would relate to rehabilitation of those civilly committed clients.
Now, at the time, there were beginning to be methadone programs. but you stated that you couldn't deal with them.
We had a policy, basically, that methadone maintenance was not part of the aftercare program. Towards the very end of the NARA, I think there was one or two that were actually allowed to enter into a methadone program, but it was only after the agency petitioned us, headquarters, and had to give a very strong reason. And the reason there was opposition to it is because it was so controversial, and the whole NARA program in itself was controversial, and because it was a marriage between the Department of Justice and the Surgeon General, the Department of Justice, I think, really was very much against methadone maintenance, much more than the Surgeon General was. And so we were doing that kind of a balancing act as well. So for the first couple of years in NARA, no patient were ever allowed in methadone maintenance. I think throughout, up until the very, very last, there was no.
When was the end?
Well, that's a good question, because it never ended.
Okay. They
quit using it when the block grants came on board.
And 70...
I don't know. I can give you that number. I've got all that legislation. I just, not off the top of my head. Things get blurred together.
So it's still on the books? They've just stopped using it?
Oh, I think what happened, there was a clause in the legislation that said that the Surgeon General can provide these aftercare services if there are no other available services. And with the block grant coming on board, all of a sudden there were other available services. So, it basically self-extinguished. But I don't, every once in a while, during the early days of NIDA, I get a report or something, some judge had just committed somebody under NARA. What are you going to do about it? And then we'd have to submit a form letter basically saying that that services is now being provided at the state level. But law, I think it just allowed itself to self-destruct.
Yeah. So what do you think of it now? Do you think that it was an experiment worth doing?
I think the experiment had to happen because it provided the transition into a different type of treatment program. I think civil commitment is a feasible approach that could be done for some segment of the population. I'm not sure it's the federal government's responsibility to get into that, though. I'm not sure that would be a better approach at the state level. But we have to keep in mind how the federal government got involved in treating drug addicts in the first place, And so it also provided a way for the federal government to get out of treating drug addicts directly.
Do you think that it, sort of at the more individual level, do you think that it improved the lives of drug addicts?
The data, we did two follow-up studies of NARA. The data clearly showed that many of them did far better than other programs. Was it cost beneficial? Probably not. It was a relatively expensive program for a small number of clients.
When you said that it helped to enable a transition, can you elaborate a little further on that? A transition from what to what?
Well, up until the time of NARA, the role of the federal government was basically providing services to hospitals, working with prisoners. When they were released, they went back to their home communities. There was no follow-up. There was no aftercare for them. They went back and probably got involved in drugs immediately again. The use of other than physicians in treating became a very important part of NARA. every contract we wrote had to have a consular in charge of their clients, and that consular was oftentimes a social worker or maybe a voc rehab counselor or somebody who had professional training but wasn't necessarily a physician, and it allowed us to show that other people than physicians could provide care.
So what would you say the effects of NARA were upon staff, people who are working at Fort Worth and Lexington?
I think a lot of people were very, a lot of the career people were very threatened by NARA. Mm-hmm. They saw this as the end of their career. In some cases, they certainly were right. The security department was rapidly decimated. Diminished. I don't, other than that, I mean, I don't think there was a tremendous loss of staff except on the security side. Some of the more progressive people were able to adapt and stay with the program. Some of them liked to get out. A lot of the people who were, you know, NARA was a short-lived program, and then once the hospital became prisons, and a lot of the people just switched over and continued working there in the Bureau of Prison Hospitals.
Mm-hmm. So when did you first become aware that Fort Worth and Lexington might be shut down?
Well, I was here at the time because I was part of the group that, you know, we sat around the table talking about how we were going to do it. And so that was when I was here with Donata and working with NARA. But I was part of the planning staff. But it was after, let's see, it would have been during the period when I was Jack Scanlon's deputy, and that would have translated to right after, I guess Bob would have been there at the time. Bob DuPont would have been director.
Maybe still Jaffe? Jaffe says that he pulled the plug. Who do you attribute the decision to close the hospitals to?
Maybe Jaffe. But see, Jaffe was at the time, he was a czar. He was a SEADAP or whatever it was called at that time. And he probably was the person. Jerry had one of our original NARA contracts when he was in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then when he became the czar, he probably did. But I'm sure he did it with the understanding that there would have to be community services and what have you available.
So you don't agree with the statement that NARA spelled the end of the hospitals, or was somehow responsible for ending their use as drug treatment facilities?
I don't necessarily agree with it. I don't think it was that this program came along all of a sudden the hospital closed down. I think this program came along that reflected a community, the national emphasis on a change in treating drug abuse across the nation. And NARA was just part of that overall change in concept and understanding what needed to be done. NARA was rather shortly conceived federal program. It was kicked around for a while, for about a year or two, and next thing you know, it was a law, you know. And there were a lot of repercussions, I think, that probably people didn't think about. But regardless of that, I think it did reflect what the nation was calling for, and that is a more therapeutic approach in the home communities of the addicts, and more humane, and some evaluation rather than just a determination that these were prisoners. You know, some of the people were sent to Lexington and Fort Worth in the early days who had no business being there. They had very short drug histories. Some judges decided that we ought to send you there and get treatment. Mm-hmm. they became hardened criminals almost as a result of being there in many instances. We had young kids come in those hospitals, and I mean, it was almost criminal what happened to them when they first came in there. I mean, young and naive, and before they left, they were pretty sophisticated. They had to be, otherwise they couldn't have survived them.
So NARA changed that?
Yeah, I don't think, that's a really good question. Did NARA change that? Not when we were doing the evaluations at Fort Worth and Lexington. We still sent them down there because that's the only place we were providing that service at the time. So some of those young people, yeah, they were down there in a place in that somewhat of a criminal environment, yeah, by all means.
Yeah, so tell me how it went from you being implementing NARA and running NARA to not doing that. What was the transition for you like? You became Jack Scanlon's deputy. Was that the moment when you stopped doing NARA?
No, new law was passed. When the Black Grants came into existence, NARA sort of diminished. We got very much involved in getting money out to the states. We had both Black Grants and we had Formula Grants, and we had to get that money out based upon where the addicts were. We had formula programs set up, so we determined where need was based upon things, a whole host of variables. And then depending on where we determined the addicts were, we put money out there in those days. So we got very much, you know, I was part of headquarters and was part of headquarters during NARA. And that's what was the topic at the hand at the moment. We had new legislation happening. This book that I've shared with you was full of a whole series of new legislation, just one after another. About every 6 months there was a new piece of legislation dealing with drug abuse. And we were trying to put them all together and get the money out and do what we had to do.
It must have been somewhat confusing what you had to do.
I think it was certainly confusing and certainly challenging, and it was also somewhat cumbersome because each legislation gave a little different approach, you know, in terms of what had to be done. And then when you got into the giving money out to the states, why, that became a whole other. You know, states had to submit state plans. We had to review them and approve them and so on before they got their money.
So you did that? You
participated.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that was another scaling up of a new kind of program, wasn't it?
Exactly.
And that was under NIDA by then?
Yeah, I guess it would have been NIDA. Yeah, it was by NIDA. But
okay.
Sure.
So when did you first hear? You were sort of part of the formation of NIDA.
Mm-hmm.
And did you play a role even before there was an NIDA?
Exactly.
Okay, and can you describe what the early months really of NIDA? I mean, as I understand it, the legislation was passed and it said NIDA had to be created by a certain time, and it was created before that time.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, frankly, it was a little bit difficult for many of us who had been working with the NIDA. We had implemented NARA, we were trying to implement it, we were implementing money, putting money out to the state. We had several pieces of legislation we were working on, working day and night. And then this special action office down there under Bob DuPont exists, and Bob was designated as the new director of NIDA. And when he came, he brought a bunch of his staff up, people whom we had not known or worked with. And those of us who had been in the bureaucracy for a number of years prior to that found it a little bit difficult to have some of these people, overnight successes, come over there and be sort of involved in directing what we were doing. I think there was some resentment on some of us about that. A few of the people that Bob brought with him are still in the field. Many are not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a little bit difficult during those early years.
Jack Scanlon, was he also headed ARC?
No.
Okay.
Jack Scanlon was, Jack Scanlon, I guess he is a administrative type who worked at NIMH, and then when Donata was created, Jack found himself assigned to Mary Drug Abuse.
So he wasn't a drug abuse person before that. And you were deputy director?
I was deputy to Jack in the planning and evaluation office for a number of years. Jack did things like, he was basically the policy person. And he and Karst and I went to lunch every day for years, and we over lunch we sat and we talked about what had to be done and what could be done and how to make things happen and so on. Karst, of the three of us, Karst was sort of the person with imagination and down-to-earth approach of things. Jack was kind of a Machiavellian guy. He could figure out how to make things happen, even if it wasn't quite right. He could always kind of finagle things and squirm around. And I found myself as sort of the doer of their ideas. But nonetheless, I was always part of the topic, those conversations, and we, like I said, we met every day. Jack did not enjoy respect of some of his peers, and I'm sure you picked that up by now. And so they moved him to different places at different times, sometimes to get rid of him, sometimes because they needed him. He's a very bright guy, but he's also rubbed people wrong and did things that people didn't like very much. So they moved Jack up to the ARC when Jerry went to. No. Bill Pollan moved him out, I guess, is what it was. No, that's not right either. Let me think it's a. When they were looking for a new director of NIDA, Bill was one of the candidates. And Bill came to me and he said, I'm one of the candidates, and if in fact I am made director, I want you to be on my small staff, one of my senior people. And he did not offer that same position to Jack. And then when Bill came on board, the decision was made to move the ARC into Baltimore. And so it gave Jack a role. And so Jack went out there to implement. And he stayed out the ARC and sort of the, I don't know what they call them, maybe policymaker or something. Mm-hmm.
And you go under Bob DuPont, you said you were more in planning and evaluation, and then you are become more policy oriented?
Yeah, well, in NIMH and in early days of NIDA, they usually had an office called planning and evaluation. And the planning and evaluation, actually the initial one of them was OPDD, Office of Program Development, OPDA, Office of Program Development and Analysis. And we did things like writing testimony, we did things like working on budget issues, justifying budgets, preparing position papers for the director, for secretaries and whatever. I mean, it was just a lot of analytic work and putting in words on paper. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, I can't even tell you the titles I've held during those 30 some years. I mean, I was deputy to this and chief of that and director of that and this and the other thing.
But what were you really doing?
Most of the time I was doing planning, evaluation, and analysis work up until the time I became director of the international program. Mm-hmm. But all the rest of my career pretty much had been doing behind the scene work, you know, to make all the other people look good.
Right.
And that was fine. That was okay with me. I had no aspiration. I did testify on numerous occasions and at Congress, and I found that difficult, but I did. I did not particularly enjoy the limelight. But I enjoyed the whole atmosphere of being around in the field, and I thrived on it. I loved it. But you know, I guess all organizations have a few people like me in the background who make it run. I don't know.
Yeah. So tell me about the international program, because that was kind of a passion of yours, it appears.
It wasn't so much a passion. It was more of the fact that I knew that, let me see. Actually, toward the end of my, when Pollen was still on board, they wanted to have someone, PAHO, Pan American Health Organization, contacted us to have someone do an evaluation of some of their programs in substance abuse. And I, at that point, was getting kind of tired of the whole thing, so I said to Bill, you know, and I had evaluation training in my doctoral program and so on, as an epidemiologist and some of
your doctoral stuff. Program?
Yeah.
When was that?
I went to Hopkins, graduated in 74, I guess. I went on a part-time basis until I graduated.
Oh, so when you moved back up here, when you moved here?
After I moved here.
You started doing a doctoral program. And what's your doctorate in?
Doctorate of Public Health.
Okay. And so you had picked up the epidemiology. Was that the main focus?
Mental hygiene. I was in the mental hygiene department under Paul Lemkow, but my minor was epidemiology, and my degree, I think, the department was mental hygiene. My dissertation had to do with NARA, as a matter of fact. And
you've got a dissertation on NARA somewhere?
Somewhere.
Okay.
1,000-page dissertation on NARA. Yeah. I've got publications on NARA too.
Yeah, yeah.
What I did on my dissertation. My thesis had to do with negative self-concept, highly correlated with substance abuse. And I used a population of white middle class heroin addicts to do the sample, and they were NARA clients. And because I knew the NARA counselors and so on, I drew a sample of people in Minneapolis, I drew a sample of people in Seattle. I interviewed them, I interviewed peers or people who were controls, and I tested them, and blah, blah, blah.
All men?
All men. I've written and published some papers on that, and if you want to be bored with that, I've got.
That's a reprint?
That's a reprint of that particular thing I did.
So somehow, in the course of doing that, you became interested in the international work?
I'm sorry, I sound a little schizophrenic. Because I had a background in evaluation and in epidemiology, and because PAHO asked to have someone do help them with that, they sent a formal request to us through the State Department, and Bill didn't know who to do it, and I said, well, I can do it, and I said I would enjoy just getting away from NIDA for a while, so I was detailed down to the Pan American Health Organization, I think it was for 6 months, to work with South American countries to do an evaluation of their epidemiological programs down there and their capability to do epidemiology. So I did that and sort of enjoyed working with the international community and with international organizations and so on. And then when I came back to NIDA, about that time, Schuster came on board and brought some of his good people on. And so Schuster asked me what I would like to do. And so I said, well, I'll do international.
And so then I became involved not only in South America, but with all the you know, global. Mm-hmm. I did that up until the time I retired.
Now, in 1974, was epidemiology, what would you say our state of knowledge of drug abuse epidemiology was when you were working on your doctorate?
NIMH and later NIDA developed a program called CODAP. I don't know if you know CODAP.
CODAP, sure. What?
Client-oriented data acquisition system.
Yep.
CODAP was a pretty good. Program for keeping track of clients who had treated in the block grant programs, and it probably was better than most systems that exist today, but it was not epidemiology. It was a data management system that allowed a collection of information about clients who were being treated. It had nothing to do with real epidemiological issues. It didn't look at anything more than just how many people were in the system, how long they stayed there, when they left. Mm-hmm. So it was really a book on Sophomore House.
Oh, that'd be fun. I'd like to see that. Leave it out. So, was epidemiology new?
No. During the very first NIDA, the head of epidemiology, although they didn't call it epidemiology, they called it something like data acquisition or something, a guy named Bill Spillane, who is now dead. But Bill was the first director of that system. It wasn't called Division of Epidemiology until Ed Adams took it over, and then later it was the AMSO. And while I worked very, very closely with them on it, on a lot of their projects, I don't think they ever would acknowledge that I was very important in the field.
And why was that?
You get a hat on when you work in the government. And I was a policy person. I wasn't a scientist. Even though I published a number of papers, I was never thought of, I think, as a researcher. I was never thought of as anything but a... Here's a paper that I did with Dick Clayton, Drug Use and Abuse in Jamaica. That's an epidemiological study.
Yeah, right. So you did those, you continued to do those when you were doing the international work? You would
this was done when I was part of that Pablo thing that got that thing started. When I got into international, my job was just to stimulate collaborative research and to go around the countries and meet the key people and work with them, try to set up a joint program. We had big meetings of scientists in Japan and the United States. We had a big meeting in Krakow, Poland. We had a big meeting in Russia. Those meetings were basically the top scientists in the field from both the United States. And either went there or we flew them here. And we set up a training program, bring their scientists over.
And you got into methadone during that time as well?
Yeah. Put together together this book on methadone for the international community. Oh, I'm sorry. Probably. It's full of
other stuff stuck in, but that's okay. Yeah, I see. So that's near the end, though, for you, near retirement.
Exactly.
And have you stayed in the field since then?
For a few years, I was writing grants for different agencies, helping them write grants, particularly with CSAT on treatment. And I've also been asked on any number of times to be a reviewer for, on grants. But with each year, you get further away from the people who are actively involved, and the phone doesn't ring like it used to. Mm-hmm. Plus, after Lona's accident, I just haven't been able to do very much because much of my time is involved.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm. If you can think of anything that I should have asked and didn't.
No, I think you pretty well covered it. Obviously, I was involved in all these programs and can give you additional information if you think of some things, but I think you've got a pretty good feel of what it is.
All right,
your time might be well spent just looking through.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do next. I think that's going to be fun.
I don't know whether you'd rather go upstairs or look through some of this stuff.